Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Pete Anderson. Today I'll be reading from the April 15th, 2024 edition of the Hartford Business Journal. The first article is titled, Thanks, But No Thanks. This is subtitled, Developers and Municipal Officials Say Prevailing Wage Costs Overtake Value of State's Economic Development Incentives. Developer Avner Krohn said the prevailing wage mandates attached to a $4 million state grant have blown a multi-million dollar hole in his plan to build the 100-unit apartment building in downtown New Britain. Now Krohn said he and the city officials are working with the State Department of Economic and Community Development, or DECD, to try to patch the financial gap in time to begin construction this summer. Krohn is among an increasing number of developers, economic development officials, and others raising concerns about the impact of a six-year-old law requiring prevailing wage for labor and private developments supported with $1 million or more in state financial assistance through DECD. The requirement was embedded in a two-year state budget adopted in 2017 and went into effect in 2018. Complaints began mounting a few years after the law went into effect. The issue could threaten new projects, creating a roadblock to Governor Ned Lamont's and lawmakers' efforts to add affordable housing in the state. DECD in recent years has been increasingly active in funding new apartment projects, investing hundreds of millions of dollars through various programs like the Community Investment Fund. That's opening up more development in the prevailing wage mandate. Additionally, developers and others say they've noticed recent changes in the way the state is applying the 2017 law. The mandate is increasingly being applied by the State Department of Labor to an entire development rather than part of a project being supported by state funding, like brownfield remediation. That has upended budgets for some new apartment developments, experts say, adding costs that exceed the value of state grants. Krohn, for example, said the added cost of prevailing wage on his $26 million development, planned to be located at a parking lot that formerly housed the Strand Theater, would top the $4 million state grant. He's already invested more than $1 million in the project, including buying the Main Street property from the City of New Britain last year for $125,000. Krohn said he's not opposed to paying prevailing wages on a portion of his development. He accepts that state assistance comes with strings, including a requirement that 20% of the units be set aside as affordable. We're not saying take away the strings, he said. We're just saying be aware if the goal is to incentivize additional housing in the state of Connecticut, then the incentive actually has to be a viable incentive. Prevailing wage has a long history in the United States, having been enshrined in the Federal Davis-Bacon Act of 1931, which established a requirement that public projects pay laborers at a rate at least equal to the wages that prevail in their geographic area. Connecticut evidently adopted its own prevailing wage requirements for public projects. Today, Connecticut's Department of Labor sets prevailing wages based on union rates. The agency also determines prevailing wage applicability under the 2017 law. Prevailing wages in the state can vary significantly by job type and geographic location. In New Britain, for example, the 2023 prevailing wages for a residential project range from $61.42 per hour for an elevator mechanic to $15 for a common laborer. A power equipment operator makes at least $43.38 per hour, while roofers make at least $41.20 per hour, according to the DOL data. Developers and consultants interviewed for this story say prevailing wage requirements typically increase costs by 20%. That's a figure contested by Kimberly Glassman, director of the Foundation for Fair Contracting of Connecticut, which lobbies on behalf of labor unions and union-affiliated developers. She contends there is no basis in fact or peer-reviewed study that supports the cost estimates. Glassman said prevailing wage protections are meant to ensure workers get fair wages that are not reliant on public subsidies for food and health care. She said her organization would oppose any effort to roll back the 2017 law, which also benefits non-union workers and is backed by contractors who understand livable wages are a key to maintaining a skilled workforce. At what point is a state going to stop subsidizing poverty wages to line the pockets of developers? Glassman said. We want to see a commitment back to the state if we're going to invest in your project. Invest back in us. Hire local Connecticut companies. Hire a Connecticut workforce and make sure that workforce is earning family-sustainable wages. Make sure they have access to secure retirement, health care for them and their families. If we're going to make that investment in you, make it back in us. However, developers and economic development professionals say some large-scale projects might not happen if the prevailing wage is applied too broadly. In a public hearing before Fairfield's Town Planning and Zoning Commission in January, a developer behind a proposed 245-unit apartment redevelopment told town officials that the prevailing wage mandate tied to a $3 million state brownfield grant would add $20 million to the project. So if I had to explain it to investors and lenders, I would have a hard time, said Thomas Montelli, a partner in Fairfield-based Post Road Residential, which proposed the apartment development on an industrial-polluted 5-acre site on Black Rock Turnpike. Fairfield Economic Development Director Mark Barnhart said he and the development team anticipated the state would require prevailing wages, but only on a roughly $5 million environmental cleanup ahead of the construction. Instead, Barnhart said, the Department of Labor decided the prevailing wages would be required for all labor on the $125 million project. The town and developer are still trying to figure out a path forward. Combined with elevated construction costs and high interest rates, losing the state grant puts the project at risk, Barnhart said. In Fairfield, New Britain, and elsewhere, DECD is working with developers and local officials who have found prevailing wage requirements unpalatable, trying to plug unanticipated funding gaps. DECD Deputy Commissioner Matthew Puglisi said his agency cannot advise a grant applicant that a portion of their project might be subject to prevailing wage. That determination is made by the Department of Labor after an award is granted, he said. Puglisi said his department has heard from a small percentage of grant recipients that are frustrated with the Department of Labor rulings. DECD is trying to navigate these projects through other financing options, Puglisi said, including reducing grants to under $1 million threshold, reducing the scope of projects, or identifying other state grant sources not subject to the prevailing wage. Some developers and municipalities in recent months have opted to reduce their grant requests to under $1 million, Puglisi said. Other projects have gone on hold while trying to resolve funding gaps. Obviously, DECD wants to see the projects move forward and happen, but DECD also needs to abide by the law that's in place that really governs us, Puglisi said. So, when developers come to us or municipalities are upset, what we try to do is steer them towards what the other way to move forward with the project could be, and we try to be problem-solving partners with them. Puglisi said concerns raised about prevailing wages have not diminished overall demand for DECD funding. Applications for brownfield grants are on pace to top the $30 million the state has set aside for this year, and the $74.3 million in Community Investment Fund awards announced in March received applications seeking $550 million, Puglisi said. The Community Investment Fund, which was established in 2022, is providing hundreds of millions of dollars in grants over several years to historically underserved communities for various economic development initiatives including brownfield remediation and affordable housing projects. Thomas Wydra, director of the State Department of Labor's Wage and Workplace Standards Division, said his agency's method of determining prevailing wage applicability under the 2017 law has not changed in the intervening years. If a municipality cleans a brownfield to advance a private development using $1 million or more in DECD-connected funding, that would trigger prevailing wage for the cleanup and the following construction, he said. I think it's important to remember we conduct a careful analysis of all bid documents, architectural drawings, contracts, and any materials associated with the project so that we can make a final determination on whether there is a phase one and a phase two of a project that's connected via those documents, Wydra said. Wydra said the number of requests to determine prevailing wage applicability have ramped up over the past 18 months, something he attributes to an increase in DECD funding projects. Ann Catino, a partner in the law firm of Halloran Sage and co-chair of the state's Brownfield Working Group, contends the Department of Labor has, in fact, changed the way it's applying the 2017 law. For a while, the development community had an understanding that the prevailing wage would be applied only to those portions of the projects funded by the DECD grant, Catino said. But in the past year or so, it has gone off the rails and there's an interpretation that is much broader, Catino said. It's unfortunate because it definitely is having a chilling effect on a lot of projects. Catino said it appears the issue will have to be settled by state policymakers, but that is a difficult prospect during this year's short legislative session. Sources close to the issue say concerns about prevailing wage mandates have been raised with DECD Commissioner Daniel O'Keefe and state lawmakers. Asked for comment on the issue, State Senator Joan Hartley, a Democrat from Waterbury and co-chair of the General Assembly's Commerce Committee, issued a statement that said, "The state's economic development is central to the work of the Commerce Committee, which continually evaluates state investments, its policies, and practices." She declined further comment. A spokesman for Commerce Committee co-chair, Representative Stephen Meskers, a Democrat from Greenwich, said the prevailing wage issue has not come before the committee during this session, which ends on May 8th. Paige Bronk, president of the Connecticut Association of Economic Development, said concerns about the prevailing wage have been bubbling to the surface for about 2 years. While the law is 6 years old, it takes years to plan, permit, and gather funding to launch a building project, especially a large multifamily development, Bronk noted. I think people are learning about it now because they are getting closer to the implementation, Bronk said. Bronk, who was also the economic and community development manager for Groton, acknowledged the issue caused his town to forego $2 million of an $8.46 million DECD grant announced in 2022. The grant was meant to subsidize an $81.4 million redevelopment of underutilized downtown lots by the Pequannock River. The Groton Housing Authority would build 51 affordable apartments. A development group led by David Preka of Advanced Construction would build just over 200 housing units. And the town would improve a riverside boardwalk and build a pedestrian bridge over the river, as well as bikeways and park space. The private housing development accounted for more than $50 million of the anticipated budget, a cost that was going to be defrayed by a $2 million from the state grant, Bronk said. But the town decided to carve out that portion of the grant after learning it would prompt a prevailing wage requirement for the entire $50 million private development. It was just not going to pencil out, Bronk said. Instead, DECD was able to connect Petka's group with the State Department of Housing Grant Program, which is not subject to the prevailing wage, Bronk said. Bronk anticipates it will take another 2 years or more for the project to come to fruition. DECD, to their credit, found a way to work with another state agency to assist that component of the project so it could advance, Bronk said. Turning now to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This is titled, State Lawmakers Seek Compromise on Earned Wage Access Regulations. Connecticut lawmakers are working on compromise legislation intended to reopen the door to fintech companies that offer earned wage access services through employers while avoiding what some describe as predatory lending practices. Earned wage access, or EWA, services, which have been used by more than 150,000 Connecticut workers since 2012, allow users to access already earned wages before payday. The Connecticut Department of Banking in September issued new guidance on the industry in response to a series of legislative changes adopted by state lawmakers in 2023 that require earned wage access companies to be licensed and regulated as small loan providers. More importantly, lawmakers also changed the formula used to determine a small loan's annual percentage rate, adding tips and subscription or convenient fees into the calculation. Those are key revenue streams for earned wage access providers, and the formula change pushed many EWA companies well past the 36% small loan APR cap set by state law. The new regulations drove unearned wage access companies to stop offering services in Connecticut, which resulted in industry and consumer complaints to the banking department and lawmakers. On one side, the banking department and consumer advocates argue that money provided by earned wage access companies comes with fees far in excess of the 36% APR allowable for small loans under state law. That could end up hurting individuals who are already facing financial challenges. EWA companies argue the cash they provide is not a loan. It's money workers have earned on the job. They stress that most services are offered free of charge with elective fees for expedited services and tips. Earned wage access providers generally operate through two models. In one, EWA companies work directly with consumers and determine early payments based on an individual's past pay history. The EWA company gets access to a company's bank account where payments are then deposited and withdrawn any fees and the advance sum on payday. In the second model, EWA companies work with employers to verify wages earned. Payment advances, plus any fees, are handed over to the employer to the EWA company and then deducted from paychecks. The General Assembly's Banking Committee has proposed and passed a revision to last year's law, changes that would ease restrictions on EWA providers working directly with employers. They would be excluded from the 36% maximum APR limit, but limited to charging only same-day transfer fees. Those fees would be set at a maximum of $4 per transaction or $16 monthly, whichever is less. The Banking Committee last month passed a bill on a 10-2 vote. The legislation is now awaiting further action in the House of Representatives. I think, again, it provides somewhat of a compromise, especially with respect to employer-integrated products, which I will submit look less like a loan than some of the other direct-to-consumer products that arguably fall under the framework and are subject to regulation, said State Representative Jason Duchette, a Democrat of Manchester, who is co-chair of the Banking Committee. The bill received mostly a negative response from consumers, consumer advocates, and the EWA industry. EWA companies argued the bill doesn't go far enough in enticing them to re-enter the Connecticut market. Consumer advocates say employer-sponsored programs, even with guardrails in the new legislation, could still harm economically vulnerable users. Attorney Raphael Podolsky of Connecticut Legal Services testified that he anticipates the proposal doesn't totally deregulate the EWA industry and still recognizes the service as a loan. Still, he argued the proposed fee caps are unnecessarily high. He argues a preferential solution to providing access to wages ahead of payday would be to have employers absorb the cost. It is very important to recognize that the most negative aspects of the EWAs are felt by the very workers that are most in need of protection, for example, those with the lowest income, Podolsky's testimony reads. Phil Goldfelder, CEO of the American FinTech Council, argued in his testimony that earned wage access is not a loan and should not be regulated as such. He voiced support for the state to establish a licensing protocol, but argued against setting distinctions between direct-to-consumer and employer-integrated models. EWA is a safe, reliable alternative to payday and predatory loans and gives consumers the ability to access the money they have already earned on their own terms, Goldfelder said. Duchette acknowledged that neither side of the EWA debate is satisfied with the committee's proposed compromise. I think you can look through the testimony that we received to see that no one who was interested in the bill was really happy with it, Duchette said. And perhaps that is a good place to be, or perhaps not. Again, we try to make a balance here. It's a difficult issue. Turning now to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This story is titled Rights of Ownership. The story is subtitled West Hartford Becomes a Battleground in Long-Term Struggle Over Short-Term Rentals. Mark Chu sees himself as a promoter of West Hartford. In 2023, he paid about $1.5 million to purchase four houses, three single-family homes and one duplex on Raymond Road, less than a two-minute walk from Blueback Square in the heart of West Hartford Center. He bought them to use as a short-term rental. One of the homes has been listed on Airbnb for several years by the previous owner. I'm an ambassador for the town, Chu said, explaining that he provides renters with information about businesses and attractions in West Hartford. You know, there's a list of restaurants, here's a movie theater, here's the shopping. I'm pushing people right where these small businesses are. Renters appreciate the information, he said, adding people love that they're able to walk out of my houses, take a right on the sidewalk, and be in Blueback Square in 90 seconds. Unfortunately for Chu, town officials don't see him as an ambassador. Instead, they view him as a scofflaw. The town has issued cease and desist orders for three of the properties, demanding he remove their listings from Airbnb. Chu is protesting the orders and will appear in front of the town zoning board of appeals on April 17th. Like many communities in Connecticut and nationwide, West Hartford is trying to rein in the growing number of residential properties listed on short-term rental apps and websites like Airbnb and Vrbo. That's VRBO. It has sparked battles among property owners, those who want to rent and those who object, and between renters and the municipal governments that are trying to regulate and in some cases ban that practice. The issue has found its way to both the state Supreme Court and General Assembly, the latter of which is considering a bill to grant communities more power to regulate short-term rentals. This is no small fight. According to AirDNA, an app and website that tracks short-term rentals, the market has grown with 2.46 million active listings nationwide in 2023. As of early April, there were 73 active short-term rental listings in West Hartford, up 49% over the past year, AirDNA said. Chu, a Plainville native who has owned Farmington-based real estate development company Instant Property Solutions, LLC, for nearly 30 years, acquired the four West Hartford properties in early June last year. He then poured about $300,000 into rehabilitating them. Two of the homes were unoccupied at the time. Just over 5 months later, he received a notice of potential violation from Robert Goslin, the town zoning enforcement officer, citing the listings for 136 and 150 Raymond Road on Airbnb. The letters, dated November 24, 2023, the day after Thanksgiving, stated that the town has received a complaint and verified that the homes were listed on Airbnb and occupied by transient guests. The letters added, "Please note our ordinance does not allow for short-term rentals in residential zones." The letter stated that Chu had violated a list of permitted uses and asked him to please remove your listing. It also warned that a cease and desist order would follow if he did not comply. He subsequently received a third notice, dated December 26th, for his house at 146 Raymond Road. The town has not cited his other house at 152 Raymond Road, even though it is also listed on Airbnb. The three cease and desist orders were issued on January 17th. West Hartford officials declined to discuss the issue in detail while the appeal is pending. Town planner Todd DeMays, though, spoke briefly with the Hartford Business Journal and unequivocally stated that short-term rentals are not permitted. Both Chu and his attorney, David Markowitz, a partner with Simsbury law firm Hassett and George, P.C., begged to differ. For starters, Markowitz said the town's ordinances do not contain a definition for short-term rentals, nor do they specifically mention them. It's not in the town zoning regulations, he said. Further, he argues that if something is not specifically prohibited, then it's allowed. That's what the case says and was argued before the state Supreme Court, Markowitz said. That's one of the rights of ownership. The case before the state's highest court is Francis Welby versus Pine Orchard Association Zoning Board of Approval in Brantford. Welby bought the single-family home in a development known as Pine Orchard Brantford in 2005. He leased the property on a vacation rental through Verbo. Pine Orchard Association governs the development and issued a cease and desist order in 2019, stating the rental violated zoning regulations updated a year earlier. Welby appealed first to the local appeals board and then to the Superior Court, arguing regulations approved in 1994 allowed the rentals. Pine Orchard Association and two neighboring homeowners who intervened in the case, however, argued that short-term rentals were never permitted and that such use was not consistent with the property being a home or a residence. The appellate court, however, ruled that home and residence mean different things, stating that a residence can be a place where someone resides temporarily, while home suggests something more permanent. The court also ruled that the 1994 regulations allowed short-term rentals. The case was appealed to the state Supreme Court, which heard arguments from both sides on March 27th. A decision is not expected for months. Well, that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the April 15th, 2024 edition of the Hartford Business Journal. I'm Pete Anderson. So long until next time.